Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's podcast, I'm chatting to director and novelist Matt Shaw about his second feature, Next Door, and his short, Nightmare on Elm Street, Up All Night. Over the course of the interview, you will hear Matt talk about the Kickstarter campaign that helped raise funds for Next Door, its very troubled production, and why, in the future, he is unlikely to cast actors from TV land again. Plus, he talks about his much more fun shooting experience on Up All Night, his thoughts on the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise itself, and how he'd like to turn the short into a feature. All of which, and much, much more, you can hear right now in our interview with Matt.
Hello, Matt. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hello, and thanks for having me, even though we've never actually spoken before, and this is definitely the first time we've ever spoken.
It is 100% the first time we've ever spoken. We definitely did not have a conversation before the recording started about the Predator. That didn't happen.
And what a git the author J.R. Park is for making me sit through it. We definitely did not have that conversation, and I did not call my good friend Justin a git.
But I mean, you did right there. It's not, it's now on the record.
Well, no, because I said I did not call him a git. Oh, so
yeah. Okay. Okay. That makes sense. That makes sense. So, Matt, we have you on the podcast today. I mean, you're a prolific man, so we can talk about a bunch of things, but... I think the first thing we should talk about, because it's now up on Amazon, is Next Door. So yes. Tell us a little bit about your anthology film, Next Door.
Next Door.
Just a kind of brief spoiler-free synopsis.
Yeah, Next Door is an anthology film featuring loads of my stories from my fucked up range of books. That's not me swearing on purpose. That's what the range is actually called. And I adapted them into a script and linked all the stories with a centrally running theme. I'd love it if you go and rent a film from Amazon, because it is available to rent or buy now. But I must warn you, it's not the best film. Did I sell it to you?
You've sold it to me. That's, Well, I mean, like, because we also, other things we didn't talk about was, you know, people having podcasts and not being diligent about learning about who their guests are. But I did rent it earlier today.
See, I warned you. It's, I mean, that film is just a comedy of errors. You know, as with any project, I'm proud of it. You know, I think we did a good job given the circumstances, but everything that could go wrong with that production went horribly wrong.
In what regard?
Well, just like one of the actors that showed up, he was such a racist, homophobic shitbag that two people said they will not come back and work on Next Door in case he came back. And I was like, well, no, he's only in that one segment, but they still didn't come back.
Are we allowed to name this actor, or are we going to get sued if we do?
I will just say he's a big actor and I will probably get sued. you know, you can probably work it out from that. But, you know, he showed up, he filmed with us for 3 hours. We had booked him for the day. After 3 hours, he demanded I take him to the train. I'm driving him to the train station and he's talking to his missus back home saying, yeah, yeah, smashed it out of the park. I'm on my way back now. Yeah, yeah, easy, easy. And I'm thinking, well, you haven't smashed it out of the park. I don't have all the footage I need. And when I reported it to the agent didn't care. The agent was just like, yeah, okay, pay us. You know, I had someone helping me get the money together to make the film. When he found someone with money, he actually ran off with the money guy to go and produce his own film. So he just left us in the lurch. And, you know, did you have the misfortune of sitting through the whole film?
Yes.
There's a scene in there where I am actually getting, how do we put this politely, hand relief from a French maid.
Yes.
I wasn't supposed to be in that scene. I found out literally 10 minutes before we were shooting that I was in that scene because the actor didn't show up. So, like I said, anything that went wrong in that film or could have gone wrong did go wrong. But, you know, go and rent it so I can get my money back.
I see there was so there was like a Kickstarter campaign for the film, right?
Yes.
I suppose that was a success. There was enough people who backed it.
Yes, and I feel very sorry for them. No, I was lucky. I mean, we kickstarted the feature film Monster, which was my debut film back in 2018, and then went straight on to Next Door after that. And thankfully, a lot of the backers came over and carried on supporting us. And since then, we have successfully crowdfunded A Nightmare on Elm Street, Up All Night, and a film that we're actually shooting next week called They Came From the Sky, I Saw Them, which is just a dusting off of our creative brains, shall we say. It's just a piss take film. So yeah, I'm lucky in that my readers do support me on crowdfunding sites. So that I am eternally grateful for.
Is there anything on, I mean, obviously you're very down on it. It was obviously a very negative experience with those various things going wrong. Is there anything you can kind of take away from it, that like the film that you're I'm proud of that though, like it might not be the greatest
given the start of how, you know, given the script at the start, to give you an idea, we were supposed to follow the postman. And the postman was going house to house, and then each, you know, it was all going to be all different houses in the original script. And we're seeing different stories from each house. And by the end of it, the postman is an assassin who kills Danielle Harold's character, who she was in the segment God's Hand with the gun on the table. But because we had to rework everything and completely rewrite everything as we were going along, I'm proud of the fact that actually when you do sit down and watch it, it is a coherent story. You know, a lot of the themes do link together. So I think as a creative project and utilizing our brains and problem solving, I think we learned a lot from it. So, you know, I don't grudge making the film. I'm happy that I've done it. I'm happy that I've had the bad experiences, because now moving into, I've actually got 3 films in pre-production now. Moving into those, I am a lot more confident when it comes to filmmaking.
Would you say, so actually one of the questions I had was like, was it any easier directing given it was your like second feature as opposed to your first feature? But since it was such a negative experience, was it actually more difficult?
No, this one was easier. The reason being, I had learned a lot from Monster. So, you know, Monster, we didn't really have storyboards. We just had a shot list and I'm just saying on a day, right, this is what I want, blah, 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 blah. You know, with this one, I drew all of the films and then I had proper shot lists and we refined the paperwork. So it made directing it really quite relaxed on my part, in that I could focus on dealing with the actors. Unfortunately, because we went down the route of hiring, you know, people from television land, there was a few egos on set. So that kind of was a bit of a bummer to direct. You know, when you're talking to someone who she's done quite a few soaps and things, you're giving her directing tips and she just leans back and she's like, yeah, 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 and shuts her eyes. And you're like, are you even listening to me now? But with Monster, we filmed that entire feature length in 9 straight days. And some of those days, Justin, J.R. Park, who was helping me out as the assistant director, he was directing the scenes because I was outside throwing up in a bush. I was so stressed. Yeah, so at least I didn't throw up when we were making Next Door.
despite the fact it seems like it was an even more stressful experience from the sounds of it.
Yeah, I just think I grew up a lot. And, you know, as I said, Justin was my AD on this one as well. And he's very meticulous when it comes to paperwork. So whilst there are issues coming up when you have a strong team around you, my first response is to rage. And Justin's first response is to problem solve. So I will sit there quietly stewing, biting my tongue, and he'll be like, well, what if we do this, this, and this? So it's good to have people like that who can keep you grounded.
What initially, before it went into production next door, what initially made you want to adapt some of your stories and make an anthology? Are you a particular fan of anthologies?
I just feel like a decent anthology hasn't been done for a long time. Hey, still hasn't. And when I was growing up, I was a massive fan of Tales from the Crypt and Tales from the Dark Side. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to bring stories like you would find in Tales from the Crypt. You know, they've got this story that's going in one path, and then by the end of it, it completely slaps you in the face with a twist ending. So I was desperate to kind of bring that experience back with each of the shorts within the film. And I thought it would be easier, foolishly, to make a series of short films and then just link them together in the edit. But, you know, I was very wrong about that.
So you say there's not been a good anthology movie made in a long time, which is interesting because there does seem to have been a kind of boom of anthology films post VHS in 2012. So I take it you're not really a fan of any of the kind of big anthology films that have come out since then, be it VHS or Southbound or Holidays or Double X.
I'm not a fan. It just doesn't really appeal to me. I like the ideas that they come with, but when they actually come down to when you sit down and watch it, it just doesn't really fit right for me. I am probably going to make a dick of myself now. There was an anthology film, but I can't remember the title, but it might have been the Coen brothers. I think it was, but they were doing short films set in the Wild West, and that was on Netflix.
Oh, the Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yes, and that started off, and I thought, this is really weird, but I kind of like it. But then it just sort of fizzled out for me about midway through. And that's what I'm finding a lot of them doing. Whereas with Next Door, I find Next Door actually gets stronger towards the end. But you got to get through the first like half of the film, which is a little bit draggy in places. And the ballad film, it went the other way, started off really good. But then for me, just petered out. I should stress that I am a real fussy film person, though.
Okay. Do you not think that... And that's just the nature of anthologies. Like, I've watched a lot of anthology films, and generally, I can't think off the top of my head of an anthology film where I was like, I really liked every single story.
Yeah, I expect some to be like up and down, you know? Some are going to be really amazing. Some are going to be like, eh. But it's, like I say, it started off great, but that, using that as a particular example. Mm-hmm. But then each story after that was just getting progressively worse. It didn't seem to be like, you know, oh, we've got a bad film here, but let's throw it in. The whole thing was just going downhill. I mean, I turned it off in the end, so it could have turned around and got good again. But when I'm sitting down watching films, it has to be really good, or I find myself thinking of work I need to get done.
I see.
Yeah, well, I'm one of those brains.
Yeah. As we definitely didn't discuss before the podcast, I'm one of those people who has to see things through to the end, much like your friend, Mr. J.R. Parks.
That is brand new information to me.
It's just a running joke it's not got old so far, but it'll probably get old quite soon.
It may be.
that was the other thing I was going to ask about Next Door was, is it weird adapting yourself to the screen? And
no,
how different are the stories... To, you know, how difficult is that in terms of like going from like short stories to like making it into a script?
I actually enjoy the process. Literally, I'm the laziest writer. I have final draft written, loaded up on one MacBook. And then my other MacBook is linked up to that MacBook with the actual story done. So then I'm scrolling the story and just writing it straight into final draft and tweaking it as I go along. And then when I look at it, I'm like, well, that's not going to work on screen. It's fine for a book, but a screen audience is completely different. So it needs to be changed. And then the dialogue needs to be changed as well, because you don't want dialogue to tell the story on the screen. You want the actions to show what's happening. So yeah, as a whole, I enjoy the process. I've adapted other people's work as well, and again, I find it quite therapeutic.
And in terms of the difference, is it in terms of adapting yourself, adapting other people, is it easier to adapt yourself? Or
oh, definitely. I think the book was called Suffer the Little Children. I can't remember the name of the author. It was Derek someone or other, but he asked me to do him a screenplay. And I had the screenplay loaded up, and I've got his book in my hand and I'm reading it, and he's got stuff in the book that it's fine. It's like the character was 40-year-old man, but he's got a 70-year-old girlfriend in the book and they're making out and things like that. And I had to tell him that whilst there's nothing wrong with that, you know, in society, you know, age just a number, you love who you love. If you imagine seeing a 40-year-old man making out with a 70-year-old woman on a big screen, my concern is that quite a lot of the audience members would find it comical or be disgusted by it, because it's not what we consider to be normal. So I had to tread very carefully around that, because I know it was based on his actual life. Mm-hmm. And like I said, age is but a number, but you have to be thinking about how an audience would perceive things. So yeah, I don't like changing other people's work, and it feels very awkward. Whereas with mine, I can just do what I want. So if I think, oh, this doesn't work, I can rip it out and I answer to no one.
The other thing about Next Door I was going to ask was who came up with the idea for the silent movie interludes? Was that your idea?
That was so you know when I said everything that could go wrong?
Yes.
Okay. Imagine we have filmed 8 hours and we are running out of daylight. We go outside to film the outdoor sequence, and the guy who's playing the postman shows up, and he doesn't really know the lines very well, because he paid to be in the film. Justin has never acted before, so he's not entirely comfortable either. Now, even though we were losing light, the sun was still in the sky, but we didn't have the right filter for the lens, so everything was overexposed. Then we had traffic, which is normally it's really quiet out the front of the house, but traffic on that day was horrendous. So I was like, I just said to the cameraman, I said, right, what if we make it grainy black and white footage? And he's like, well, we can do that. I said, then all I can do, because otherwise we're going to lose it and I can't afford to get everyone back because of the budget restrictions, we will have to make it black and white footage, cheesy music over the top, and carded dialogue like a 1920s Charlie Chaplin film. So yeah, it came up because we were problem solving on the fly.
It's quite a fun workaround.
It was the only workaround we had. The other option we've got is to film it all and then try and do ADR, where we get the actors to do the dialogue and try and lip sync it to the screen as close as they can, and then put the dialogue over the top. But that wouldn't have solved the fact that everything was overexposed on the camera. So it just wouldn't work.
Yeah. That would, yeah, for sure. But it was definitely, I mean, as workarounds go, I mean, it's inventive thinking is what I meant to say.
It made it quirky. I like some of them. The original cut that we had of the film, there was about 9 of those sequences, and they got old real fast. You know, you're like, oh my God, another one.
Right, I can imagine that would be, way too much.
It was like one of the films is about 4 minutes in the segment, and then suddenly you're straight back into another black and white sequence with that that same music again. You're just like, no, please just kill me.
Make it stop.
Make it go away. I want to watch The Predator again.
Send a whole bar for yourself.
Well, you know, I've kicked myself down in the dirt low enough and next door, so I might as well stay down there now. You know you've made a shit film, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you pay people from television land to be in your film and they love the script and they're up for it, bloody, bloody, blah. Then when the film is out, not a single one of them pushes the film. And you're like, well, thanks for the support, people.
So they all just abandoned you.
Yeah, but I mean, I've been talking to other filmmakers and, you know, we both used one of the same actors and he was like, yeah, this guy doesn't talk to me anymore either. The only reason he pops up occasionally is because he wants to do a feature length of the short film we've just done. So he'll be like, hey, let's make this. And then he'll disappear again when I say I'm busy. So I was like, yeah, I get the feeling now.
So whose idea was that then to hire from TV land? Did you think,
that was my idea.
That was your idea.
Yeah, because the reason being, one of the people in the film we've got is Vaz Blackwood from Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. The guy's done a lot of work. And I thought if we got his name on board, when it comes up on Amazon, people will find the film because his name's attached. And, you know, then he'll tweet the film and we'll get some more people from Twitter. And it just never happened. I mean, when the film was released, Vaz actually did a message just saying that he was proud of me for getting it done. But there was no link to the film or anything. So I was like, well, thank you for the nice sentiment. But, you know, the plan was they get on board, they push the film just once is all I was asking. And then we get some of their audience go and rent it out of curiosity.
But none of that happened at all?
No. When it went to Vimeo, because it took months to get the film approved on Amazon, when it went to Vimeo, two people pushed it. Jeremy Edwards and Nicole Faraday. They were the only two to push it. And, you know, it kind of hurt because I thought, yeah, we all had a good relationship. And clearly, when you walk away from the film set, doesn't matter who they are, these people were only ever there to line their pockets and they don't actually support the film afterwards. And I you know, it's a horrible thing to say, but it's a horrible thing to feel as well as an independent filmmaker. So another lesson I learned on that set was I will never work with someone from the television world again, because there's so much untapped talent out there that I had to turn down some truly amazing actors because I favoured a name instead, and I should never have done that.
So in these features that you've got coming up, you're going to work on kind of just more unknown actors and just people who pop at you as being talented and best.
Yeah, exactly. In February I was over in America making Nightmare on Elm Street Up All Night, and there was an actress who reached out to me on Backstage, a casting website. I really hope she doesn't hear this because I'm really going to mess her name up now. It's Rebecca Tarabochia. She's Swedish. And she did the audition. And when I was watching it, she did loads of micro expressions with her face. And she reminded me of Sybil Shepherd from Taxi Driver. And I just thought she was absolutely amazing. So I went back to her and I gave her some directing notes. I was like, can you do the same thing, but can you do this, this, and this? And she sent it back within a few days and absolutely nailed it again. And she's just one person. There's so many people out there like Rebecca who just need that one shot. And sadly, you have people like myself where we are in the film world an unknown quantity, so we try and get a named person to help bring us an audience, and really it just doesn't work. So you are better off just using the best person for the job.
And I watched the Up All Night on YouTube. I checked that out. It's
which, you know, version?
two versions. Yeah, well, I checked out the writer's cut That was
okay.
You posted like last week or something.
Yes, because when we were out in America, we had access to a Pinhead costume. So we were like, hey, why don't we do this, this, and this? And we all just got carried away with it. And we should never have done it. So where I actually ended it in the film that you saw is where I ended it in the screenplay. And then it, you know, it leads on to a feature length screenplay if there are enough people interested. And so far, one person's offered me $80,000 to go and make a feature length. But I just don't have the time at the moment.
It certainly seems like it would have been fun to film. Obviously, there's a bunch of Easter eggs in it and, you know, references to various things. You know, the bar you're in is Craven's Bar. And,
yep.
You see the, even in the writer's cut, you see the puzzle box from Hellraiser and different stuff like that.
Yeah, well, in the feature-length script, one of the characters is being questioned in prison. Well, you know, in down in police station, and their friend is waiting for them out in the corridor. One of the doors opens and a police officer comes out and he's got an evidence bag. And in the evidence bag, he's got a Chucky, you know, child's play doll. So he hands it to the desk sergeant and says, can you put that back in evidence, please? And he's like, oh, I thought we got rid of that. It creeps me out. So just little Easter eggs like that towards horror franchises in general, because I love that kind of thing.
I was going to ask that. Is Nightmare your favorite franchise, or are you just a fan of those like 80s franchises like Nightmare, Friday the 13th, Child's Play?
You know, I don't actually know what my favorite is. I mean, I don't get all geeky like some people, because I was friends with the team behind Friday the 13th Vengeance, and watching all the Jason fans literally shitting a brick because this new Jason Voorhees film is coming out. I've never been to that level of like, oh my God, it's Jason Voorhees. It's like, I watch the films and I can enjoy them for what they are. Like Michael Myers. Freddy was my first boogeyman that scared me when I was growing up. So that's probably why I'm closer to Freddy. But I actually think my favorite is probably, even though they completely bollocks it up, the Texas Chainsaw. You know, I love Leatherface. That sounds weird.
Yeah. Do you not think it's like, I mean, the Nightmare series and like even like Halloween and Friday the 13th, there's like a few sequels there that are fun. They're pretty fun. As a Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a bit of a slog as a franchise. Like the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre, masterpiece. The second Chainsaw Massacre, quite a fun film. After that, it's hard.
I didn't mind the one, the remake, where they did it in 3D, and it had, the shouty guy from Full Metal Jacket in it as a copper. Right. I didn't
that's
mind
not
that
the 2003 one. Remake.
You know, it might be. I can't remember the date it came out. I remember it was like, that was the first remake that came, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then there was a bunch of sequels and various things off of that movie.
Because then I watched, I think they just called it Leatherface.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Wow, what a turd.
Yeah. There's some awful, awful entries into the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise.
But then, you know, look at some of the Halloween films. Look at some of the Jason films. Like, some of them are just dog shit. Even with Freddy, by the end of it, you're like, all right, you need to let this franchise down. I made the mistake because I was working with Mick Strawn on Nightmare on Elm Street Up All Night. Mm-hmm. For those that don't know, Mick Strawn is the production designer for Nightmare 3 and 4 and a series called Freddy's Nightmares. And I made a mistake of getting Freddy's Nightmares on DVD. I would be embarrassed to put my name to that. And this is coming from the guy that made Next Door, you know?
Yeah, I think I did see like an episode of that or something on like the horror channel.
It was nothing to do with Freddy, but Freddy would like introduce it like the Crypt Keeper.
Yes.
I'm like, yes. What is this?
It's just a terrible, terrible cable show. Yeah.
Yeah, and like Mick was like, yeah, I was part of that. And I was like, mate, I wouldn't shout that out. You know, you did Blade and Boogie Nights and Sid and Nancy. Shout those out. Ignore Freddy's Nightmares. Let it die.
Even Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and 4. I mean, they're fine. You know, like Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is the Dream Warriors is the best one after the original. So even that's pretty cool. But yeah, probably just ignore Freddy's Nightmares.
Yeah, the problem I had with, I think Mick asked me, he's like, so Matt, what is your favorite nightmare? Just to fuck with him, I said, Wes Craven's New Nightmare. And then I was like, I went away and I was thinking about it. And obviously my favorite is number one.
Yeah.
But I was like, actually, Wes Craven's New Nightmare is actually a good film.
For sure it is, yeah.
You know, I enjoyed it. And three and four, they got a massive following for themselves. They were always, it kind of changed Freddy at that point, you know? You know, I like Freddy to just to be evil like he was in Wes Craven's and in the first one. Even the second one, he was evil. But the third and fourth, he was a bit more comical.
Yeah, absolutely. By that stage, he had become like, he'd become the protagonist. He'd become, you know, like the person that you're really following. Because, I mean, to an extent, I think, you know, the victims in three are likable enough that you're still kind of on their side. But then even like the later sequels, it's just like, they're just cannon fodder. You know,
yeah, you want Freddy to kill him.
Yeah, you know, in the last couple, like they've like five and six, they're absolute just cannon fodder. It's just terrible. They're just rubbish.
I really want to hit up Wes Craven's at State and talk to them about an idea that I've got for the film, but I just can't get anywhere near them to make it even worth my while, because I know I could send a letter in, but how many people are going to be doing that? And you just think, oh man, if you'd let me sit down with you and Elijah Wood, I reckon I could come up with something special for Freddy.
That would be, yeah, I could certainly see that. But I know that you're very busy anyway. You've got various projects on the go. You mentioned one earlier. We'll leave next door behind them. We'll talk about them. So what was the original concept for they came from the sky? I saw them. Is that based on one of your stories?
I got drunk and went around my brother-in-law's house, and I was sitting at the table and I was like, you know what we should do? We should do a space film. I was like, but we should make it shit, like one of Ed Wood's films. You know, I don't know if you're aware of Ed Wood.
Yeah, I'm
aware. Yeah, like Plan 9 from Outer Space is just, it's terrible but brilliant at the same time.
Yeah.
And it was literally just because we'd both been drinking. We both started drawing these little ideas for scenes. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go away and I'm going to write this. And then I was like, well, why don't we get the films of Ed Wood and mix it with Monty Python, Hot Shots, Naked Gun, Airplane, and just put it in a great big pot, mix it all up and see what happens. So yeah, it's nothing I've written before. I wrote it specially to film. It was never supposed to be taken seriously. It was just that we were all going to come down and film for free, just have a laugh, because obviously we've all been locked down. And now it's become something where people are actually asking for it. And you're like, oh, crap. I've just put a lot of pressure on myself.
Well, it does sound quite fun. I like spoof movies and I like bad movies. So
It's a stupid, stupid film. I mean, the script took half an hour to write. You know, and it's a 50-page script. So you're looking at over an hour's worth of runtime. And I keep going back and just adding little directing notes for things that I think will be funny visually. So you've got the comedy in lines, but then you've got the comedy on the screen as well. Like, because we raised over £2,000 on Indigo, we decided let's not film it in a real location. Let's build the sets. So that's what we've done. But all of the sets, so we've got like living room, kitchen, bedroom, they've all just been screen printed on like a stage setup. So when you look at it, it's literally just pictures stuck to a wall of a kitchen. So when she's washing up, she goes to put the plate on the side. Obviously, there is no real side, so the plate will just fall and smash on the floor. But when that happens, the actress will ignore it completely and just carry on as though everything is normal. And you're just like, what are we doing? But I'm hoping that when people watch this, they'll understand that we're just having fun.
I presume they will. I mean, I presume that are you just a fan of Ed Wood, or are you a fan generally of kind of those kind of so bad they're good movies like The Room or Troll 2 or
The Room? I will not watch, but I did watch Disaster Artist, which gave me enough insight into The Room. Troll 2, I think, is brilliant. It is absolute rubbish, but I love it. Ed Wood's films I enjoy because I love the guy's passion, you know. Yeah. And the fact that the films are done, the films are released, so he done it. He made his films. Fair play. And even today, you know, knowing in mind he is considered one of the worst film directors of all time, today I still talk about his films. You know, that's got to be something. And then Justin made me watch a film called Them. I don't know if you know that one.
Is that the giant ant movie?
That's the one. It's so bad.
Yeah.
But again, when you sit down, like, I mean, maybe not back then, but in today's world, when we sit down and put one of those films on there, you know, on the screen, we already have an expectation of what that film's going to be.
Absolutely.
So that's what I need to tap into when people watch They Came. They need to watch it with that kind of mentality, because if they go in thinking, oh my God, I can't wait, it's a new Matt Shaw film, this guy's like Tarantino, I mean, bollocks anyway, but they are going to hate it, everything about it.
But I think that's part of the reason that it kind of intrigues me, and I think it's something I'd probably watch. But because I have seen a lot of those movies, I have seen a couple of Ed Wood films, you know, there's Plan 9 and Glenn or Glenda. I have seen all the major good bad movies that people have talked about, you know, Manos, Hands of Fate, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, you know, like all those ones. So it'd be in my wheelhouse.
Well, I was just, by the end of it, I was just being a dick. I mean, like, one of the characters in the film is literally a cardboard cutout. So when he's on screen, he's got, it's a police officer, he's got his other police officer stood next to him doing all the lines. And then when the guy's like, well, thank you, officer, for coming around, I'll show you out, the other officer picks up the cardboard cutout and just walks off. And again, no one ever mentions anything about it. And I think that's what will make it just bizarre for people. And then I found out Maria Lee Metheringham, the actress that's in the film, she absolutely hates the word moist. So there's a sex scene in the film which now uses that word three times. And then we go to a Eurovision style dance number where the song is just called Moist.
Wow.
And I only did it to fuck with her, I'll be honest.
That's quite cruel, Matt. It's quite cruel.
Yeah. Well, it swings and roundabouts, because she knows, and this is weird, I hate the feel of velvet. Oh,
okay.
So we have a scene together, which is, you know, nothing shown and it's not rude or anything like that, but it's an intimate scene. And she said she's going to be wearing a velvet nightie for that scene. So I was like, you motherfucker.
Yeah, like you say, swings and roundabouts.
Yeah, it's all good fun. It's just banter, yeah, you know.
For sure, for sure. So you're working on a variety of other projects as well. I saw you're working on one, a kind of slasher called The Cabin.
Yeah, I'm actually working, before we get to The Cabin, I'm supposed to be doing a film called Love Life, which is based on one of my books. It's a cross between Leaving Las Vegas and Psycho. We've had to put that one on hold, although I still haven't officially announced that it's on hold, because I live in hope, because I'm flying in Mick Strawn, Sabrina, who I work with on Nightmare, and a guy called Peter Anthony to actually be in the film, and they're flying in from America. But obviously America's shut to us at the moment.
Obviously,
we're supposed to be filming in January, and I don't think it's going to happen. So I wrote The Cabin because it's a very, very simple script to shoot. It's minimal locations, minimal cast. Again, it's based on one of my books, and it's a proper ghost story. And I love ghost stories, you know, like shit your pants supernatural ones, not cheesy over the top CGI and gore or anything like that.
Yeah.
But then yesterday I wrote a script called The Box based on one of my other books, and I was like, well, that's even less locations and less actors, and I can make that film. So I'm actually going to jump into pre-production for both of those. But then next year, on top of all that, I've actually got the lead role in a film called Caliban, directed by and written by a guy called Ian Armour. But again, we're just waiting for COVID to sort itself out before we know when we're shooting it. So I've got all of these little projects up in the go at the moment.
And you seem like you're somebody who just can't help but write. You're just I looked on your Amazon and wrote 190 short stories. You've got a long list of books out that we've not discussed your book output much. What is there's just the kind of compulsion?
Yeah, I mean, years and years ago, when I was in my 20s, I used to have like real anger issues, and I was just a bit of a mess. And I ended up going to the doctors, and the doctors told me to write a diary down so they could try and work it all out. And I went away and I started writing what turned out to be a book I released called I'm Fine, which is all about depression, self-harm, and what I do to combat it. And I found it so therapeutic to write it that I thought, I enjoy this process, so I'm going to carry on writing. And when I was in my early teens, I used to write film scripts for fun because hey, let's go to college and film them. He never did, but it was still something I enjoyed of an evening. So I started adapting all of those old film scripts into novels and novellas and short stories. And I actually found myself as a calmer person for writing it all down and getting out of my system, you know?
And you've just done it ever since?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote my first book when I was 12. A parody of Red Dwarf called Red Elf, which was, as you would expect, pure shite. And then screenplays when I was in my 15s. Then I did my first cartoon book. So I cartooned a bunch of sperm, and I published that in my early 20s before writing I'm Fine. And I've been writing ever since. And then in my early 30s, I wrote a book called Sick Bastards, which overnight just took off straight to number one. I sold the film rights, and then all of my other older books started selling, and then I just quit working.
And what happened with the film of Six Bastards?
Absolutely fuck all. What they do is they give you a chunk of money to option something, but they option lots of things. And then they'd go away and have meetings and throw ideas around. And then out of, say, 10 that they optioned, they'd produce, say, one or two. So after X amount of years, the rights just revert back to me, so I can go ahead and sell them again now. When I sell film options, I never sit back and think, hey, I've made it. I always presume that they're just going to come back to me, because I'm friends with, I don't know if you know him, the author Adam Neville.
I've heard of him. I don't know.
Well, he wrote The Ritual, and he said that he sold the film options to that. And it was a long, long process before it then got turned into a film. And the whole time he had people telling him, you know, don't get your hopes up, don't count on this, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, lucky bastard that he is. It did not only get made, but actually did very, very well as well.
Yeah, it was quite a decent sized film on Netflix.
Yeah, I went to cinema and watched it. So, I mean, I'd love it to happen to my work, but Adam's a really nice guy, so I'm pleased for him. Jealous as fuck, but pleased.
So, yeah, what can you do in terms of, like, the projects that you're working on going forward with all the COVID restrictions?
Well, like, we're filming next Friday, as I said. I've bought like a temperature gun. I've said that I'll be the one doing all the cooking for the crew and cast. because I'll be like masked up and gloved up. And then if you want extra food, you know, come see me, and then I'll mask up and glove up and dish you up. And then everyone will be socially distanced except the actors, and the actors will be signing stuff stating that they're happy to do this and they don't think there's anything wrong with them. And, you know, so it's just more paperwork, really. But without trying to put myself in a hole, does anyone really care about this anymore? You know, the amount of deaths have gone down. I believe it's a very real thing. And I think we all need to be very careful, but at the same time, we can't stop living our life. We just need to use common sense. I mean, that being said, the COVID situation has impacted us in that we can't fly people in and out very easily, and I can't go over to the States to do a film that I was supposed to be doing. But yeah, when we're here, I think it's just, you know, just common sense now.
Yeah, I think, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of people not using common sense, but yes, I think you're right that,
Well, you mentioned that there's another actress that I've recently worked with, and she is on Twitter and Instagram just sharing stories that, you know, COVID is not real, it is to do with the 5G network. She refuses to wear a mask and she refuses to socially distance, and all she's done is guaranteed I will not have her on set, because when I go to a shop, as much as I hate wearing a mask, I will wear one out of respect for those around me, and because I don't want to try and put myself in any position, you know, stupid position. If you have someone so openly bragging that they're going to ignore everything and it's all bullshit anyway, then why would you want to introduce that to a film set where she could be carrying something, she could pass something on? So yeah, common sense is needed, and sadly some people just lack it.
That is absolutely crazy. The whole 5G thing is just,
oh, you know what,
unbelievable.
I used to wonder about radiation for phones and everything, and then I went and worked for the company 3.
Yeah.
And they went into all of this side of the conversation about radiation and said, actually, these are the facts and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it hasn't much changed from there. You just get people, I don't know, I just seen they get a kick out of trying to create drama, you know? Oh, I'm going to make a conspiracy theory and everyone's going to listen to me because I'm great. No, you're not great. You're a twat.
Do you know what? The great, I mean, it's self-evidently bullshit, the whole 5G conspiracy. But I interviewed for the podcast two Brazilian filmmakers who live in Sao Paulo, and they have their own conspiracy theories over there, and the 5G conspiracy theory had not reached them. What also had not reached them is 5G itself. Don't have 5G in Brazil, but they do have the coronavirus quite badly. So that's, punches a rather big hole in that one. Well, not that, no, it needs to be punched.
the problem is, in Brazil, it's a very poor country, and the government would actually come under fire. And there'd be a massive rebellion if they were found to have done a deal to introduce 5G into Brazil. So what they had to do is they did the deal, and they paid a lot of money for it, and they brought 5G in, but they kept it hidden from the everyday person. So the everyday person isn't aware that 5G is actually all around them, giving them corona.
Ah, they brought it in via stealth, right?
Okay. Yeah, that's I bet if you have a conversation with a 5G person,
yeah,
you
know,
5G
yeah.
nut, I bet one of them will say something like that.
I know. It's the secret shadow government, you know. Yeah. ruled by the Illuminati.
Yeah, and just for the sake of the listeners, because I'm aware that there's a fair few of them probably don't know me, I am taking the piss about what I just said about 5G in Brazil, okay?
Spoiler warning, yeah, we're not buying it. yes, listeners, we're very much on the side of sanity on this podcast.
Well,
I mean,
for some things,
you know, we like the fun side of insanity, where there's certain things that we frown upon.
Exactly.
For sure.
But But I don't know. I just think the world's gone to shit. And I think there's going to be a massive divide with this coming up. You know, I go out. I'm scared to go out soon because I have to have this procedure where I have a tube shoved up my nose and then down my throat and left there. And I'm like, I'm fucked if I'm having that up there and wearing a mask at the same time. But I bet people will still give me a mouthful because they'll see I'm not wearing a mask, even though I've got all these cables and things taped to my bloody face. In fact, I might just go around supermarkets all day and then round shopping in Southampton with a hidden camera just to see how many people do have a problem with someone who has clearly got medical issues not wearing a mask. Clearly, I'm bored.
Well, that's that's certainly an interesting note to kind of bring our interview to a close.
Matt Shaw is bored. Fuck off.
That's the end of this podcast. No, I'm kidding. Well, Matt, obviously, you're filming next Friday. Do you have a kind of release date in mind, or is it just all up and totally up in the air?
With this particular film, that's not something I can actually discuss with you without having to kill you. Doing is, because everyone's working for free, I've got a really, really good sound engineer working on this when we finished the edit, but he's fitting it in around his real work. So it's really going to be down to him, because I will have the film shot in 4 days. I'll have it edited within 2 weeks after that as a worst case scenario. And then it's down to him. So I'm hoping to get it out by October, November time. But I say, because he's working for free, I won't ever be able to push him and hurry him up, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, we look forward to seeing that. And if you're going to push
I'll
out,
send you a copy, you lucky bastard.
Okay. Well, I'll definitely check it out whenever it arrives. It could be out by the time this podcast is out, then I can put it in the show notes for you. But it's been great to have you on the show, Matt.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
It's been great talking to you.
Yep, it's been great. Thank you.
That was my guest, Matt, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest edition of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify, because it really helps with those old algorithms. Yeah, and the podcast biz is all about those algorithms. So please do that if you like the show and want to support the show. Thanks, guys. That's all for this time, but be sure to join us next time when we have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!